is there any sort of plan if the bill does not pass tonight? What is the plan?
It's going to pass. So that's it.
Well, if Sean Spicer says it's going to pass, it's going to pass. Take it to the bank.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
It's not going to pass.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Not even going to be a vote.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, Capitol Hill and media are embroiled in this fight over the GOP's attempt to curtail health care for millions of Americans on Thursday and to install the far-right nominee into a stolen Supreme Court seat. While all of that is going on, Donald Trump's promise to build dirty oil pipelines that had been blocked by the Obama administration, all of that is moving ahead nicely, thank you. Though there could be a problem for at least one of them. We'll head up to Canada shortly here to hear about what might block the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline once again and keep that pipeline from actually being completed after all. In the meantime, hey, happy 7th anniversary of the passage of Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act. The bill falsely derided by dishonest Republicans as a government takeover of health care was signed into law by President Obama 7 years ago. In response, Republicans had vowed in the U.S. House for passage of the bill meant to dismantle the Affordable Care Act on Thursday. So before we discuss how that's going, hint, not going well, there's this new poll out from Quinnipiac, inconveniently for Republicans. On Thursday, American voters disapprove 56-17%, with 26% undecided, of the Republican health care plan to replace Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. According to a Quinnipiac University national poll released on Thursday, 56-17, U.S. voters oppose the Republican health plan 3-1. And to make matters worse, support among Republicans is just a lackluster 41%, 41-24%. If their U.S. senator or member of Congress votes to replace Obamacare with the Republican health care plan, 46% of voters say they will be less likely to vote for that person. 46%, while only 19% say they will be more likely to vote for that person. Fewer Americans would be covered under the GOP plan than are covered under Obamacare, according to 61% of voters, who are absolutely correct about that. The director of the Quinnipiac poll, Tim Malloy, says replacing Obamacare will come with a price for elected representatives who vote to scrap it. That, according to many Americans who clearly feel their health is in peril under the Republican alternative. Now, mind you, Donald Trump has been telling these Republicans in the U.S. House that they will be in trouble, that they will pay a political price if they don't pass this bill. Now, moreover, the cuts to Planned Parenthood, which are these funding cuts to Planned Parenthood, have been snuck into this repeal bill. That is also strongly opposed, even among Republicans. The poll says when it is explained that federal funding for Planned Parenthood is used only for non-abortion health issues, American voters oppose cutting federal funding to Planned Parenthood 80-14%. That includes, among Republicans, 60-32%. That, of course, is when they're told that, hey, federal funding is already barred for use with abortion. But in the simple question, without that explanation, voters still opposed cutting Planned Parenthood funding 61 to 33%. Voters also oppose 74 to 22%, including a majority of Republicans. They also oppose cutting federal funding for Medicaid. Only 12% of American voters say the Republican health care plan will have a positive impact on their health care. Other than that, it's going great for Republicans, Desi Doyen.
Well, from what I'm hearing, this is something that's been borne out by previous polls, that when the American people hear the actual terms and the actual facts, not colored by politics or the stupid ideological stupid things that Republicans say, when they hear the truth and the facts, they actually support these things. I'm glad they're finally hearing the truth.
Well, they're finally hearing the facts, it sounds like. They're finally understanding what this is going to cost, what getting rid of the dreaded Obamacare is actually going to cost them.
After 7 years of demagoguery and lying to them.
Yeah, and media failure in not actually pointing these things out.
Exactly.
Let's see. One more point here. 20% of voters feel Trump and Republicans in Congress should repeal the entire Affordable Care Act. That is just 20% of voters believe that. In the meantime, 77% say only a part or none at all of Obamacare should be repealed. In the meantime, as far as Trump is concerned, voters disapprove of the way he is handling health care, 61 to 29. Not going well for Republicans when it comes to their attempt to get rid of Obamacare. But voters, even Trump voters, clearly hate the Republican scheme to replace Obamacare. And yet House GOP leaders and the White House, including Trump himself, have been busy all night and all day trying to horse trade to modify the bill in order to win just enough votes for passage in the House. But that ain't going to happen, at least not today, it seems. Leadership had vowed to rush this vote through in order to ram this repeal and replacement bill through Congress on the 7th anniversary of Obamacare, no matter how unpopular the bill is with their own constituents. And no matter what the fact that the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan CBO, has warned that it would result in 24 million Americans losing their health insurance coverage over the next 10 years. They don't care. They just had to get this thing rammed through, all of which suggests that, frankly, it is less about their voters. It's less their voters they're worried about than their funders, like the nation's largest right-wing advocacy and lobbying group, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They have come out strongly in support of this bill. And if you don't know the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, they are not a U.S. government agency, despite what their name sounds like. They are the nation's largest corporate lobbying group. And they've said, while they would like to see further improvements, that passage of this legislation is absolutely critical to restore choice, flexibility, and innovation to America's healthcare markets. Now, that may not be going over well, you know, this support for this bill among some of the rank and file Republicans. But boy, oh boy, for some reason, Republican leadership really, really wants to take the chamber's advice here. So this is all moving very quickly. But I want to just Alice Olstein over at TPM just gives a great idea of where the day started on Thursday. She says the day began dawned in disarray. As of 9 a.m., the vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act had not yet been scheduled. The House Rules Committee had not finished its markup of the bill after 13 hours of debate and was scrambling on Thursday to override the House policy of forbidding same-day votes on bills. They're not supposed to vote on the same day that they finish marking it up. This is something that the House, the Republicans, have been, you know, furious about whenever Democrats tried to do this, but they were trying to work around those rules. At the same time, a planned meeting of the House Republican conference was canceled at the last minute, but some lawmakers didn't receive the memo. They were seen wandering into the room. Negotiations on major policy changes that would have impacted millions of people are ongoing, making the likelihood of a Congressional Budget Office analysis of the final bill before the vote close to zero, although we just got word the CBO did come back with a score of something. I'm not sure which version they got. We'll get to that in a moment. But it has just been absolute chaos, apparently, on Capitol Hill. And one of the things that they've been doing is trying to win over the votes of the Freedom Caucus in the House. And to do so, the leadership and the White House has promised they would dismantle the so-called 10 essential health benefits of the Affordable Care Act. What are those 10 essential health benefits that they are willing to do away with? In your insurance policies? Well, here's the list. One, outpatient care. That's the kind that you get without being admitted to a hospital. That will no longer need to be included in health insurance policies. Trips to the emergency room would no longer have to be covered. Treatment in the hospital for inpatient care. Care before and after your baby is born. So prenatal care. Mental health and substance use disorder services, that can be ended. That includes behavioral health treatment, counseling, psychotherapy for mental issues. Prescription drugs would not have to be covered. Disability or chronic condition coverage, which if you are injured, this includes physical and occupational therapy, speech language pathology, psychiatric rehabilitation, and more. Your lab tests would not have to be covered. Preventative services, including counseling, screening, vaccines. Pediatric services, including dental care and vision care for kids. All of that was required in every plan that was offered on the Affordable Care Act exchange. The Republicans are willing to do away with all of that in order to get this thing passed, in order to, you know, be able to go out and say, well, hey, we actually made premiums cheaper.
You don't get anything for it,
you
can pay all you want for that premium. It'll be cheap. But when you actually need the health care, it won't be there.
Well, it'll be $10. You can have a $10 health insurance policy and you are covered. Now, it might only cover you for, you know, $200 when you end up in the emergency room. But hey, you know what? They always say people need to decide what it is they need.
Well,
apparently,
yeah.
They need to.
We need to shop around for that emergency room care when you're just in that car accident.
Exactly. They say that, oh, you know, some people don't need emergency room coverage. So, why do people need to pay for cancer care when they don't have cancer? So now some of those things look like they're actually going to be included in a bill that eventually, if it does, passes the House. But if that happens, some of those essential benefits, if that happens, Democrats in the Senate are going to go to the parliamentarian and say, no, we can't pass this with a 50-vote majority vote. We've got to have a full 60. The Republicans are hoping in the Senate they can get away with passing this stuff that is budget related with a simple majority vote instead of having to get 60 votes and try to overcome a filibuster, which they could never do. They're having enough trouble even getting a simple majority of 50 in the Senate. This is an absolute disaster. And now we are learning that even making the plan so much worse that it cuts essential health benefits, even that was not enough for the Freedom Caucus.
So it still wasn't cruel enough. Oh, my goodness.
It's going the other way. Congressman Chris Collins of New York said, for every vote you pick up on the right, you're now losing two on the left. And for every vote you pick up on the left, you're now losing two on the right. This is an absolute disaster. It's an absolute disaster for Republicans. About an hour or so ago, from AP, prospects for the Republicans' health care bill looked grimmer by the minute as Donald Trump failed to get a deal with a block of conservatives, leaving the legislation short of votes in the House. GOP leaders were meeting behind closed doors to determine the next steps, with moderate-leaning Republican lawmakers now also bailing on the legislation. It looked increasingly unlikely that the vote planned for later Thursday would happen, and now it won't. House Republican leaders have abruptly canceled a planned vote on the GOP health care bill Thursday afternoon. House GOP leadership aide confirmed to NBC there would be no vote before Friday. Mark Meadows from the Republicans Freedom Caucus, he's the founder of the Republican Freedom Caucus, said, I can tell you at this point we are trying to get another 30 to 40 votes that are now in the no category to vote, trying to get them to vote yes. 30 to 40 votes. If they lose just 22 votes in the U.S. House, this thing does not pass. The AP confirms that they have counted at least 31 solid no votes. So, not going well. Not going well for the great deal maker Donald Trump in the U.S. House, apparently. We'll see if the GOP can even get a bill, can get a vote on this on Friday. In the meantime, the CBO did come out with a score. I haven't gotten to read it yet, but the headline from AP says that the revised GOP health care bill reduces the deficit less than their earlier version, and it does not improve coverage. So the earlier version would leave some 24 million Americans without health coverage that would otherwise have it under Obamacare in the next 10 years. This does not improve on that. And instead of the, what was it, something, 330,000...
337 billion, I think, was
it? A billion. It would reduce the deficit by 337 billion.
The old bill.
The old bill. This one reduces it by about half that amount, 150 billion over the next 10 years. So the bill is getting worse in many regards for Republicans, and, well, that's where we are. All right, before we get to James Wilt, let me hit this very quickly. Top Democrats moving on from one mess in the U.S. House over to the other mess in the U.S. Senate. The top Democrat in the Senate on Thursday, Chuck Schumer, said that he will oppose the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. He encouraged other Democrats to reject President Donald Trump's choice for the U.S. Supreme Court, setting up a showdown with majority Republicans.
After careful deliberation, I have concluded that I cannot support Judge Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court. His nomination will have a cloture vote. He will have to earn 60 votes for confirmation. My vote will be no, and I urge my colleagues to do the same. To my Republican friends who think that if Judge Gorsuch fails to reach 60 votes, we ought to change the rules, I say if this nominee cannot earn 60 votes, a bar met by each of President Obama's nominees and George Bush's last two nominees, the answer isn't to change the rules. It's to change the nominee.
Shortly before Chuck Schumer's announcement on Thursday, Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey, Democrat, who faces re-election next year in Pennsylvania, which narrowly reportedly went to Donald Trump, Bob Casey announced his opposition to Neil Gorsuch as well. He said he had serious concerns about Gorsuch's rigid and restrictive judicial philosophy. That's good, because as we've noted, it's a stolen U.S. Supreme Court seat and no Democrat should vote for it, period. Just because you're allowing there to be no institutional punishment for having stolen this seat over the past more than a year since Antonin Scalia died and the seat opened up and Barack Obama had nominated Merrick Garland. So the opposition from those two Democrats, Casey and Schumer, comes after 2 days of hearings in which Gorsuch apparently emerged unscathed among Republicans in any event. And yet, even with that, some Democrats have said reportedly, according to Politico, that they are looking to make a deal with Republicans. A group of about six Democrats are trying to make some kind of a deal that they will allow Gorsuch to go through in exchange for what? For something. In exchange for not destroying the filibuster, not doing away with the filibuster, which is what Mitch McConnell has indicated he may be willing to do if Democrats hold tight. As of now, if no Democrats vote for Gorsuch, Mitch McConnell is going to have to, well, Gorsuch will be blocked. McConnell is going to have to come up one way or another with eight Democratic votes in order to get Gorsuch through, at least without destroying the filibuster, doing away with the filibuster, which he'll be able to do on a majority of on a majority vote with just 50 votes. But in order to do that, he's got to convince 50 Republicans that doing away with the filibuster is a good idea. Now, Politico's report is sort of unsourced. We don't know who it is, who these Democrats are who are trying to work out this deal with Republicans. But I just wanted to point it out. In case you would like, in case you live in a state where your senator is a Democrat, but Donald Trump won last year, and those are the Democrats who apparently seem to be very worried, those senators who are going to be up for re-election next year in Trump states. Those are the ones you need to call the most. The phone number for Congress is 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121. If you'd like to express your opinion either way on this, you need to ring in. Democracy doesn't only take place every 4 years. It takes place now. One of the things they're looking at doing, the Democrats are looking at doing, is saying, okay, we will approve Gorsuch if you don't blow up the filibuster, so that we can save our fight for next time, under the premise that Republicans would not just blow up the filibuster next time.
Hostage taking works.
Apparently it does with Democrats. Don't let that happen. If you give a damn about the Supreme Court, and if you give a damn about this unprecedented theft of that Supreme Court for the next generation. If you want more Paul Ryan's and Donald Trump's, you know, to be deciding how life works in this country, then everything is great. If not, give a call to your senator, 202-224-3121. That same number also works, by the way, to get through to your congressman in the U.S. House if you'd like to ring in on this disastrous chaos going on around the Republican health care bill. But with all of this chaos, some of Trump's plans to dismantle the nation and the planet along with it are moving ahead with much less attention from the media, almost no attention, in fact. And one of those disturbing stories is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to the broadcast on Radio Sputnik. I should have listened to my mama. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As you know, one of Donald Trump's first acts upon taking office was to issue an executive order meant to clear the way for the completion of two massive oil pipelines that had previously been rejected by the Obama administration, both the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is set to ship North Dakota Bakken shale oil across about six states, and the Canadian-owned Keystone XL Pipeline, which its owners, TransCanada, have been trying to complete for years in hopes of shipping dirty tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, down through the Midwest and to the Gulf of Mexico for export overseas. Over this past weekend, according to AP, an appeals court refused a request from two Native American tribes for an emergency order that would prevent oil from flowing through the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. The AP reports the decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia means that the $3.8 billion pipeline set to move North Dakota oil to a distribution point in Illinois could be operating as early as this week, even as the tribe's lawsuit challenges the project, and that that case will continue to move forward. But they will not get that emergency order they were hoping for. The Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes have been challenging an earlier ruling by U.S. District Judge James Boasberg not to stop final construction of the pipeline. AP says they also wanted the appeals court to halt any flow of oil until the case was resolved. But the appeals court said the tribes had not met the stringent requirements for such an order. The tribes had asked the lower court judge to direct the Army Corps of Engineers to withdraw permission for the Dallas-based developer Energy Transfer Partners to lay pipe under Lake Oahe in North Dakota, which the Corps manages for the U.S. government. The stretch under the Missouri River Reservoir is now the last piece of construction for that Dakota Access Pipelines. The tribes, of course, have feared that, as we've reported now for many months, that the pipeline could harm their water supply, would corrupt their sacred lands, and their right to practice their religion, which they say relies on clean water. Energy Transfer Partner disputes all of the above, and the tribe's appeal now rests on the religion argument. Judge Boasberg has said he does not think that the tribes have a strong case on appeal, and that, therefore, Energy Transfer Partners would be substantially harmed by a delay in pipeline operations and completion of construction. So that's the Dakota Access Pipeline. It looks like the effort to block that by the Native American water protectors in North Dakota, will have failed now that Donald Trump is in office, at least until the case can be heard on appeal, though that seems unlikely to happen before oil starts flowing through that pipeline sometime this week. But what of the Keystone XL pipeline? That process to restart construction on that pipeline over the U.S.-Canadian border will likely take much longer, given that the Canadian company TransCanada was required by law to resubmit their application to the U.S. government for another full review. Over at the DeSmog blog Canada, James Wilt writes, almost a full decade since applying for a presidential permit, TransCanada looks set to finally receive go-ahead in the U.S. for its massive $8 billion Keystone XL pipeline. But here's the thing, he notes. U.S. approval, while a great leap forward for TransCanada, does not guarantee the Keystone XL pipeline will actually ever be built. President Donald Trump, he writes, was elected with the explicit promise to get that 830,000 barrel per day pipeline open under the conditions that the U.S. would receive a, quote, big chunk of the profits or even ownership rights, and that it would be built with American steel. Well, as we have previously reported, the Trump administration has already flip-flopped on the pledge that it be built with American steel. But while TransCanada has resubmitted their application just 2 days after Trump's January 24th executive order, that application, Wilt reports, is now in the hands of the State Department, which Politico reports today, citing anonymous sources, plans to approve the cross-border permit for the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline as early as Monday. While we can likely guess how a Trump State Department is going to rule on that application, a State Department now run by the former head of ExxonMobil, the process for completing the pipeline construction may not be as much of a slam dunk as many believe, according to Wilt. To explain why that may be the case, we're now joined by James Wilt. He's a freelance journalist based in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and a regular contributor to DeSmog Blog Canada. He's also written for Vice Canada, CBC Calgary, Alberta Oil, and Fast Forward Weekly. James Wilt, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really appreciate you joining us, because this is actually potentially some good news amongst a whole bunch of dark news down here in at least these United States. You offer three reasons in your piece at DeSmog Blog Canada that you think that the Keystone XL may not be quite the slam dunk that it certainly appears down here to be, James, certainly on the heels of the quick turnaround for Dakota Access. So let's walk through. You offer three general categories of reasons why you think it may not be such of a slam dunk. First, you point to the economic conditions for building the massive tar sands export pipeline. And you say that that's changed since the issue was last examined by the Obama administration. How so?
Well, for sure. I mean, we've seen global oil prices sort of plummeting over the last few years. And the reality is that oil sands bitumen is very expensive to extract. And so for a lot of companies, it's not as viable, and we have seen a lot of international companies such as Shell and Statoil sell off their assets just because they have opportunities in other regions which are more profitable for them. And so new pipelines rely on long-term shipping agreements. And so, you know, even if Keystone does receive regulatory approval from the State Department, it doesn't necessarily mean that the pipeline will be built, because at the end of the day, the economics are all around the shipper agreement. So it has to be these oil sands companies who do believe that they will be receiving a good return, you know, from that pipeline over, you know, 10, 20 years. And we saw Enbridge CEO Al Monaco. They tried to build a Northern Gateway pipeline through Northern BC that was blocked, and now they're interested in other pipelines. Now, he argued that we Canada only needs two more export pipelines to, you know, for the next decade or so, or until 2025. Mm-hmm. And this has been something that's been backed up by market analysts, is that, you know, three or four pipelines, which are sort of on the table right now, just aren't required for the economics of oil in the near future. And so this sort of puts Keystone, a big question mark over Keystone. We'll for sure need two pipelines for what the oil sands expansion is required, but it's not something that is guaranteed for any more of that. Now, of course, if oil prices did bounce back, say to $70, $80, and that could be the result of anything, a war in Iran, a revolution in Saudi Arabia, then this would be a completely different story. But currently, at, you know, $35, $37 per barrel, which is how much Western Canadian Select gets, there's no greenfield or new projects forecasted in the next few years. And so this means that, you know, the contracts are big financial gambles for companies. And so at this point, you know, adding 830,000 barrels of oil per day doesn't necessarily represents a super good thing for the upstream companies. And so from people I spoke to, they just said that the massive expansion, should it happen, might not even mean financial benefits for the sector itself, because what this also results in is cost overruns. We've seen this happen before, where wages skyrocket and the cost of actual production increases far too rapidly for the sector to actually make a profit from. So there's a number of different reasons why the economics just aren't looking super great right now. Now, again, none of us know what the oil prices are going to be, you know, 5-10 years from now. But if oil prices do stay where they are now, or, you know, in the realm, it's not a good case.
And so when you talk about the need for, there may, just may not be the need for this pipeline, is that after taking into account that Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had recently, supposedly a liberal, by the way, but he approved two different pipelines within just the past few months. So is that keeping those two pipelines already in mind? You're saying after those, there really may not be the need for this additional, for the Keystone XL?
Well, that's the argument. Now, Trudeau's position is a curious one, because not only have they approved Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain and Enbridge Line 3, which happened at the end of November, but they've also expressed continued support for the Keystone, which was approved by the Canadian government back in 2010. So those two pipelines add about 1 million barrels per day of capacity, which will increase the oil sands capacity quite significantly. And then this is where the environmental thing comes into, which we can discuss later. But just if those two pipelines do go ahead, then that's going to give, you know, far, like, definitely enough, you know, production capacity for the near future. And there's also oil by rail, which is a really controversial issue. But if you combine oil by rail with Line 3 of Enbridge and of Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain, it's going to be certainly enough for a while. And so we do look at the Keystone, and even though Trump and Trudeau may like the idea, it may just not be in the interests of, you know, big capital up in the Athabasca oil sands.
Well, it may not, but, you know, I'm looking at, you know, the question, and you cited this a bit earlier, but can we rely on prices remaining low? So actually, specifically, can TransCanada rely on prices remaining low, you know, given unstable world conditions right now? Frankly, we got kind of a crazy guy in our White House down here. Is this something that, even though it might not be it might not make immediate sense, they might say, hey, look, we don't have a lot left here to sort of get over the border. We've got someone down in the White House who is friendly now. Let's get this thing done while we can. Get it while the getting's good, in other words, whether it makes immediate economic sense or not.
Well, it does make a certain amount of sense, but also we have to remember that in recent years the U.S. has greatly increased oil and gas production domestically via the shale revolution. So we've seen that, like you mentioned, in the Bakken and in North Dakota, and also in the Eagle Ford and Permian in Texas. And so we've seen a really big domestic production increase. And so the question now for a lot of Canadian producers is there is certainly going to be some capacity which can be exported to the U.S., but is it going to be enough? And then there's also the talk about opening up federal public lands by Trump for access by oil and gas. So that's a big question mark there, is just in terms of how much more the North American market is going to be flooded with oil from the U.S. And something that TransCanada's former CEO, Hal Kvisle, has said to the media is that the TransCanada really needs to do a job of regaining the trust of the oil and gas upstream producers and convincing them that there is an economic case to be made. And so this is something that's really going to come down to mid to long term forecasting. And right now, I mean, we're just not seeing a lot of potential for new greenfield production. You know, after 2020, there aren't a lot on the table. There are a lot of approved or under construction projects in the oil sands, but there's nothing that's confirmed after 2020. A lot of companies are just sort of sitting back and waiting to see if oil prices rebound. And like I said, if Trump does proceed with opening up the federal lands and does, you know, allow for increased production, which we're all expecting, then the case may not necessarily be that good. Now, there are issues around refineries in the Gulf Coast because production has been decreasing from Mexico and Venezuela. They do have heavy oil refineries there. And so there's about 1 million barrels which are decreasing from those two countries. And so there's potential opening, you know, from that. But then we've also got Enbridge Line 3. We've got the potential for more mainline expansion to that network. And so there's just a lot of oil capacity already flowing south. And so it may not necessarily be the economic case that Keystone is required, let alone now, but even in like the mid future.
Let's move on to your second point here of three, why the Keystone XL may not ever get built. Landowners, you say, and this one we've been watching closely over the years, because there are a lot of folks in Nebraska whose lands specifically will be kind of bisected by this pipeline, who are still fighting it in Nebraska?
Yeah, well, we've already seen some flare ups. You know, landowners in Nebraska specifically have begun to meet and to sort of you know, discuss how they do want to continue to resist Keystone. And yeah, again, we're going to kind of see this play out over time. But I think after what we've seen happened in Standing Rock, around the Dakota Access Pipeline, the resistance there led by Indigenous peoples. And then, you know, just the alliances that have been formed over the years. We did see the Cowboy Indian Alliance in 2014, which united a lot of Indigenous peoples in Nebraska, as well as farmers and landowners. And so we never know what those lawsuits, if it does go to that, are going to amount to. But even just the political needle moving and just you know, bringing the you know, the nation and the international community's attention to this could end up, you know, hurting the reputation of TransCanada. And you know, TransCanada is quite bullish. It did file a $15 billion lawsuit against the United States after Obama vetoed you know, the project. And so it's, you know, sort of unsure how much they do care about reputation at this point. But, you know, from people I talk to, there is, you know, strong argument to be made that there will be state-level resistance, especially in Nebraska. And that could also, and this is something we might talk about later on the environment thing, but there's also the potential for climate-based litigation where people are filing lawsuits based on the future emissions associated with oil sands pipeline expansion. And so, you know, you kind of combine all these things, the landowners, you know, the Indigenous peoples, and then sort of just the international community's, you know, attention since Standing Rock and since some other issues. And we're seeing the same thing heat up around Kinder Morgan and, you know, just going west through BC. And there's the same sort of resistance coalescing around there. There's a treaty alliance against tar sands expansion, which is, you know, uniting hundreds of different, you know, First Nations and Indigenous communities across North America. And so, you know, now more than ever, we're really seeing a unified resistance, which could prove to be quite the pain in the butt for TransCanada in terms of reputation and other issues.
And one point I want to underscore here, because it's we've covered it over the years, but it really hadn't gotten a lot of attention in this country. You note that there were more than 100 Nebraska landowners who were fighting TransCanada's eminent domain rights. And again, this is a Canadian pipeline for Canadian profits being granted eminent domain here. You would think that Republicans in the U.S. would be the first in line to object, frankly, since they've claimed for so many years that eminent domain was a government, land grab and everything else, but apparently not for pipelines. But when it comes to Nebraska and the Republicans up there, a lot of people don't remember it was the Republican state legislature and the Republican governor up there who actually stopped the Keystone pipeline, the original route. That was one of the big holdups during the Obama administration. Has there been a change, James Wilt, as far as you know, in the Nebraska legislature? Are they cool with whatever the new route is at this point for the pipeline? Can we expect any state resistance, any government resistance from the state of Nebraska, as far as you can tell?
Well, I mean, the governor has indicated support for the project, and just recently, 33 of 49 Nebraska senators, petitioned the Public Service Commission, which is ultimately responsible for deciding whether the pipeline gets a state approval or not, to approve it. And so, a majority of state senators are now in support. So it sort of seems at this point that while landowners and indigenous peoples on the ground may be quite concerned about the project, at the state level, it's looking quite optimistic for TransCanada, which like you note is surprising given sort of the Republican and conservative movements, alleged interest in private property rights and those sorts of things.
Yes, alleged is exactly right.
Yeah.
It's an objection of convenience, it seems. I know there was the original route was rejected by the Nebraska government. Did they complete a new route, the alternate route, as far as you know, in Nebraska?
They did. Yeah, and now it's up to the PSC to decide on whether that proposed route is good for the state. It's going to pass through 9 counties, and it does require a board of 5 people to approve the route through the state. And so, yeah, TransCanada has submitted it. But it's really up to the board to decide if it's going to get the go ahead.
Gotcha. All right. Finally, you cite the environmental and climate issues that could slow or delay or even end up blocking Keystone XL. You may have heard down here in the U.S., James, our government no longer believes in such concerns, particularly when it comes to the climate. But in Canada, the story may be a bit different, and you guys are actually following, I guess, the protocols out of the Paris Accord. What are the environment and climate issues that could end up blocking the construction in that regard? Never mind, if it's good for the environment or the climate or anything else, but just legally, you guys have certain caps, right?
Yeah, so the Alberta government, the provincial government, as part of its climate leadership plan, introduced a 100 megaton emissions cap on the oil sands specifically as a sector. And so the oil sands currently account for around 68 or 70 megatons per year, which is really significant. It's, far larger than a lot of entire provinces in terms of their annual contributions. But what that means is it's only going to allow the sector to grow by about 50% in terms of production. And so this is another thing that companies are going to have to begin to factor in to their long-term forecasting and whether they decide to sign up on these pipeline contracts with TransCanada is how seriously they think that the future Alberta government's going to take the cap, if that cap's going to be overturned, and then also where the federal government's going to be at that point, because, like you say, there has been a pretty significant climate agreement signed among the provinces. It's called the Pan-Canadian Framework, and all but 2 provinces have signed on to that, and that's going to mandate a $50 per ton carbon price by 2022. And so it's not enough to derail future It's not enough to prevent future oil sands expansion, but again, it's just putting sort of that financial pressures on, and it's going to be sort of an implicit price on carbon, which is far greater than even $50 because of that 100 megaton carbon price, or carbon cap, rather. And so, you know, all these things sort of combine, and it's we could see a million barrels per day increase just via the two pipelines that Trudeau approved back in November. And, you know, the big question for the oil sands right now is, can they cut per barrel emissions? So, you know, can they reduce the amount of CO2, you know, kilograms of CO2 that's emitted from every barrel produced? That's a big question. Industry is saying that they can. A lot of critics are saying that it's talk. Greenpeace's Keith Stewart, who I spoke to, said that since 2007, these companies have been talking big about solvents, which is a way of reducing water consumption and greenhouse gases. And so, especially given that, you know, oil prices are low, usually R&D budgets also decrease in these sorts of times. And so, you know, we may see oil sands companies, you know, come up with this silver bullet, which will, you know, save them from, you know, having to actually confront the emissions cap. But if oil prices do rebound, and if they don't come up with something like that, then it's really going to make it economically difficult and, you know, also fairly environmentally infeasible just because of that cap.
Well, we'll have clean, dirty oil sands just about as soon as we have clean coal down in this country.
Right.
James, I got just a minute or so here, but very quickly, you cite in your piece over at Smog Blog Canada, Chevron's recent submission to the Securities and Exchange Commission, noting that climate-related litigation is growing. It's an increased danger to the bottom line for fossil fuel companies. What evidence do you see that fossil fuel companies are really concerned about this increasing legislation? And you mentioned one, the case that kids have now been allowed to file a lawsuit against, I guess, the U.S. government and elsewhere, that, you know, the governments need to protect the climate for their future. But how do you see more and more litigation now actually making things more difficult for these fossil fuel companies?
Mm-hmm. Well, Newsweek had a good article on March 11th, I believe, which sort of documented sort of the increasing trend that we're seeing here. So the story that they led with was that the South African government actually lost a lawsuit over a proposed coal-fired power plant simply based on, you know, potential emissions coming from that. And now, of course, it's a country-by-country situation, but they also note that we're seeing, you know, similar situation in Austria. There's a planned international airport that was blocked over concerns with emissions. And then there's, you know, there's other issues in Europe and U.S. and Belgium, which are cited, which all sort of, you know, lead one to conclude that this is something that companies are becoming increasingly concerned about, and rightfully so. You know, we're seeing the case with the 21 kids in the U.S., which is going to be a really fascinating one to see unfold, and it does seem like there are concerns in the Trump administration over the potential for that. So, you know, it's always perhaps a little optimistic to put too much, you know, faith in the court system. I mean, like you were mentioning with the Dakota Access, you know, and though a lot of tribes not really making much progress via that route, but there, you know, there have been some examples which, you know, lead one to potentially believe that there are increased cases. And, you know, Chevron did submit to the SEC and say, you know, this is something that, you know, may impact potential investments, which, you know, for people who are concerned about, you know, greenhouse gas emissions is a positive thing.
That's the optimistic James Wilt of the Smog Blog Canada. You can read his article, Three Reasons Why Keystone XL May Never Get Built. Very optimistic. Actually, it's not. I think it's a very fair article and smartly laid out. We'll see if it comes to pass or not. But, you know, we'll take any glint of good news we can find down here in the U.S. Thanks, James. James Wilt, you can find his work at desmog.ca, and you can find him on the Twitters at James_M_Wilt. Really appreciate you joining us here today, James, and I hope you don't mind if we call you in the future when this thing actually gets built and you're proven completely wrong.
Absolutely. No, I'll be happy to. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Thank you, James. Okay, a quick break, and we're back with our closing few minutes. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is the Bradcast. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik.
Oh, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait,
yep. Hey, just time left for some quick listener mail here. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. This from Michael T. concerning Citizens United and our conversation about it yesterday via our Facebook page here, actually. Our Facebook page is The Brad Blog. Michael writes, "Hi, Brad. I listened to your radio show today, was intrigued by your discussing dark money and Citizens United. You brushed over Donald Trump not having the billionaire money of other candidates. That's not true," he says. "After Trump got the nomination, Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca's super PAC switch from Ted Cruz to Trump. Over the summer, they took over Trump's campaign, bringing in Steve Bannon from Breitbart. Mercers are co-owners after 2011 and a $10 million investment there. And Kellyanne Conway from the same super PAC. Rebecca Mercer was part of the Trump's transition team. With Citizens United, the Mercers are serious political power brokers with a strong right-wing libertarian agenda. Very dangerous. Trump owes them for the victory. Best regards, Mike." Thanks for those thoughts, Mike. You are, of course, absolutely correct in regard to the Mercers and some other millionaires and billionaires backing Trump as well. I didn't mean to brush over it as much as I was trying to make a larger point while on short time on yesterday's show. You can download it at bradblog.com if you missed it. Let's see here. This is Art M. writes email to bradcast@bradblog.com. Art says he's an appellate court public defender, and he was responding to one of our shows this week on the GOP's stolen Supreme Court nomination. "Hi, Brad. Great show as usual. Here's what I added to an appellate lawyer forum post on the Gorsuch hearing, with which you might agree. No Republican nominee should get any votes. By blocking Garland, the Republicans stole a moderate liberal Supreme Court from the majority of American voters who have voted against the Republican presidential candidate in six of the last seven elections. The damage a, quote, conservative Supreme Court will likely do in the next few years could last for decades. The failure of majority rule when it comes to the Supreme Court is a constitutional existential crisis for the United States. At some point, the majority will realize they don't have to accept life under minority rule by plutocrats and authoritarian fake Christians, or a constitution that allows that to happen." Art. Thank you for that, Art. Excellent point. And this note from Thomas P. That came with a donation that was sent to bradblog.com/donate. Thank you, Thomas. He writes, "Thanks for all you do. Great to hear your in-depth coverage of the most important news not being heard in the MSM. Brad and Desi are two voices I can actually listen to intently while painting."
What?
Yeah, I know. Which is a rare quality. He says, "Thanks for being tolerable despite the dark news," says Thomas P.
Huh.
Well, first, maybe I should add that as a tagline for the Bradcast. Quote, tolerable.
Indeed.
But I am surprised he's able to tolerate my ranting and railing and stay serene enough to keep painting. I must be doing something wrong, Des. But I do appreciate the kind words and the support, Thomas. You too can stay serene by stopping by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. It is tremendously appreciated, especially now. So thank you in advance for that.
And thanks for those comments. That's nice to hear. All of those interesting points, Paul.
Indeed. My thanks to you, Desi Doyen, our producer. Also to James Wilt today, my guest from DeSmog Blog Canada. And to all of you who spent a portion of your day or night with us. It really is greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. As I noted, you can send me email at bradcast@bradblog.com and find us on the Facebooks and the Twitters, where we hope you will find, follow, and share us far and wide, or just harass us there. We'll take anything. We're easy. You can find us at Twitter and Facebook at The Brad Blog. All right, that's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.